Lecture 27, The Shaky Foundations of Social Security.
I found that it's always wise to start discussions of Social Security by dealing with a leading myth that needs to be addressed head on. The myth is that everyone has a Social Security account with your name on it. Your contributions go into this, and you get that money back after retirement, kind of like a bank account. If you believe this myth, all I can say is it's not true, it never was true, it's not scheduled to be true in the future. Instead, for most of the history of Social Security, the money you paid in went right back out the door to people who were elderly at that particular time. Now, it's true, they keep a record of what was paid in, and those who paid more in get more back out at the end of the day. But the higher earners don't get as much more back as they had paid in extra. There's a lot of redistribution to lower earners built into the system. By the late 1990s, for example, for a typical high earner, the benefits they received were equal to about one-fourth of the income in the year before they retired. For a low earner, however, their Social Security benefits tend to be a bit more than half of the income in the year before they retired. So there's a certain amount of redistribution going on in the system. The grave difficulty for Social Security is that any pay-as-you-go system runs into difficulties. When you have a large generation of workers retiring, being followed by a smaller generation who are the ones who need to pay for them. And as we've mentioned a few times before in these lectures, the baby boomers, the group born between 1945 and 1960, will start hitting age 65 in about 2010. Moreover, life expectancies are going up. For men, for example, the life expectancy was 67 years in 1970, but by 2030, it's projected to be about 76 years. For women, it was already 75 years in 1970, but it's projected to be 82 years in 2030. And there's some reason to believe that those life expectancy projections from the Social Security Administration may be a little bit too pessimistic compared to what's happened in some other countries. So, as a result, we're going to see longer life expectancies and older folks being a larger share of the population. Those over 65 were 9% of the population in 1960, 11% of the population in 1980, 12% by 2000, but by 2025 they're going to be 18% of the population. That's going to be a significant jump. Together with these higher life expectancies, retirement ages are actually dropping, meaning there are more retirees at earlier ages. And let's just talk about men here so that we don't mix up the retirement issues with the gender issues. But in 1960, if you look at men ages 55 to 64, 87% of them were in the labor force working. By the end of the 20th century, that 87% had dropped to 67% in that 55 to 64 age bracket. Or if you look at those aged 65 and over, in 1960, 33% of those men were working. By the end of the century, it was only about 16%. So retirement is happening earlier and earlier for more and more people. The bottom line of all this is that there are going to be fewer workers to pay the pay-as-you-go taxes to support beneficiaries. The ratio of workers to beneficiaries was roughly 5-1 in 1960. By the year 2000, it's about 3.3-1. And by the year 2040, it's scheduled to be 2-1. So that's a significant change in how many people are paying in taxes to support those folks after retirement. Now, before considering the problems of the future that can come up here, it's worth pausing a moment just to consider all the good that's been done by Social Security, which is a beloved and highly successful program. In 1959, for example, 35% of those over the age of 65 were below the poverty line. A third of old people were also poor people. Even as recently as 1970, 25% of the elderly were poor. But today, the poverty rate among the elderly is down to 12%. And in fact, the poverty rate among the elderly is lower than the poverty rate for the rest of the population as a whole. Under Social Security, we have about 37 million people getting old age or survivor's benefits, and another 6 million people receiving disability of some kind. The average monthly payments to a retired worker are about $745. The average to an aged spouse and a retired worker who are living together, a two-person household, is something like $1,200 a month. Now, that's not enough by itself, of course, for a great standard of living, but the idea of Social Security from the start was to supplement it with private savings and with pensions. And if you've bought your house and you've got Medicare to help out with your medical insurance, you can do quite well, or at least pretty okay, getting Social Security. Moreover, your Social Security payment is ultra-secure. It doesn't go up and down depending on what the stock market does, and it's adjusted upward every year for inflation, so you're protected against an awful lot of risk. Well, what about these Social Security surpluses that we hear so much about? It was already clear back in 1983 that in the long term, the system was going to run into some problems. Every 4 years, the Social Security system appoints a quadrennial commission of outside experts to examine the system. And in 1983, the quadrennial commission was led by Alan Greenspan. Yes, that same Alan Greenspan who ended up being head of the Federal Reserve during the 1990s. The Greenspan Commission proposed a number of changes, some of which were enacted that we'll be talking about. But the biggest fundamental change in the system was that they began to shift it away from being a pay-as-you-go system to a system which built up surpluses in advance. By the late 1990s, the surpluses were accumulating at a rate of $80 billion a year, and the surpluses were growing. The total amount built up by the surpluses by the end of the 20th century was going to be about $800 billion. So the Social Security system was collecting more in taxes than it was paying out in benefits, and quite a lot more. Let me sort of look forward, and all of these sorts of years can move around a little bit depending on future projections and future events, but it'll give you a sense of where these surpluses and where the overall Social Security program is going in the next few decades. The annual surpluses within Social Security are scheduled to peak in the year 2006 at about $124 billion a year. By 2012, the new taxes coming into the system will be less than what's going out of the Social Security system. However, we'll be getting interest from the surpluses that were built up over time, so the trust fund will continue to grow. The trust fund peaks out at about $2.9 trillion in 2018. And to put that in perspective, if we were doing no tax money into the system at all, and you were paying all of the benefits just out of the trust fund, that $2.9 trillion would be about 3 years' worth of benefits. However, you notice that at this time in 2019 and so on, it's still true that the system is relying very heavily on taxes coming in. By 2025, for example, even though they're slowly cashing down that surplus, it's still true that only $1 out of every $5 that Social Security pays out is cashing in the bonds and the interest. The rest, the $4 out of every $5, will still be coming from current taxes. By 2031, we're out of money in the trust fund. We only have the taxes coming in, and they'll only be enough to pay about two-thirds of the promised benefits. So at that point, Social Security is officially broke. It can't pay the benefits that it promised. Now, how do we look at the relationship between these Social Security surpluses and the budget surpluses we talked about in the previous lecture? There are a lot of different ways to look at the overall federal budget. For example, you could say, as I talked about in the previous lecture, that we have a surplus because defense spending is down, or tax receipts are up, or any individual reason, but it's as fair as any of those reasons to say that we really have a surplus because Social Security has a surplus. In fact, the size of the Social Security surpluses pretty much matches the size of the overall budget surpluses up through the first part of the first decade of the 21st century. Now, in 1983, when they were reforming the trust fund and the Social Security program and switching over to a funded system with these surpluses in the trust fund, you have to remember this is in the middle of the Reagan tax cuts, and people certainly weren't in favor of higher taxes. But because of the popularity of Social Security, they were willing to pay more for that particular program. And as a result, they've been able to build up surpluses in that program. Now, one of the interesting things is that because they were willing to build up surpluses in that program, now we have overall budget deficits. Of course, now if we react to, say, having these budget surpluses by saying, okay, now we're just going to give them back to the people, we're going to have tax cuts, we're going to have spending increases, then we're in effect offsetting what we decided to a few years back in terms of building up Social Security surpluses. I mean, maybe we would have gotten a budget surplus without Social Security, but at least to me, it doesn't look particularly likely. Is this Social Security surplus in the late 1990s really there? Cynics often point out that all the surplus is invested in treasury bonds, which are really just government promises to repay in the future. They say the surplus is just paper, or it isn't really there, and in some sense, that's correct. Essentially, this is true of any financial savings, like money in a bank account, or bonds, or stocks. It's just paper. It isn't really there. But this is a special kind of paper. It's paper that involves ownership, and it involves promises about the future. Really, what people are pointing to when they ask whether the surplus is really there is they're posing a deeper question about difficulties of saving for the future. When you think about all the goods and services to be consumed off in the future, say between 2025 and 2030, many of those goods and services can't easily be stockpiled in advance. For example, we aren't setting up big piles of food and clothing that people are going to wear between 2025 and 2030. We aren't saving by putting aside real things like food and clothing. Instead, what we're doing is saving with financial savings, stockpiling financial assets that people in the future will be able to use to buy those goods. However, there's no way to avoid the issue that for society as a whole, lots of retired people around 2020, 2025, 2030 are going to want lots of consumption. And the workers of that time, by and large, are going to have to produce the stuff which is being consumed at that time. To try and understand the role of the trust fund and whether it's real or not, it's useful, I think, to consider two different possibilities. Here's one possibility. We don't have a surplus. We just don't build it up over time. So in the future, if we're going to pay the benefits that we've promised to retired folks, taxpayers would have to pay lots of extra taxes, or else we won't be able to afford those benefits. So that's one scenario if we don't have a surplus. Now, what if we do have the surplus? What does that do for us if we have a Social Security surplus? Well, what that means is that in the future, taxpayers have to repay those bonds which are in the surplus in the Social Security Trust Fund. So taxpayers in the future still have to pay higher taxes in the future in order to support the elderly, but now they're doing it to repay bonds instead of just kind of out of the goodness of their hearts. Now, the U.S. government has never defaulted on bond payments. And so, since it has never defaulted on bond payments, really, when you have those bonds, they're a way of commitment. They're a way of having a promise. They're a way of saying that together with the taxes coming in and that promise, which is seen in the bonds, there will be enough to cover the promised Social Security payments through 2030. I think the real way to think of the surplus is not as, I mean, it is paper. It's not really there in real assets, but it's more of a reason to trust that those payments will actually be made over that time period. However, that time period only goes out to about 2030 or 2031. How do we deal with the problem which arises after that, when we're going to come up short with how much money we've got and how much money we need in Social Security? Well, all the ways of saving Social Security involve, really, either higher taxes or lower benefits. The question is just how do we do this in a way which is most palatable? Let me talk about a range of different solutions that are out there and give you a sense of the pros and cons. One is what I sometimes call the 2% solution. And the 2% solution is higher taxes. What does the 2% solution look like? Well, Social Security is funded by a payroll tax. Employees and employers each pay 7.65%, which totals up to 15.3%. Now, in the minds of economists, of course, this all comes out of the employees' total compensation, but that's an issue we discussed earlier. Of that total payroll tax, 1.545% each, or 2.9% overall, goes to Medicare. So we're just going to subtract that out, think about that in the next lecture, and instead just focus here on the 12.4% tax which goes to Social Security and also covers disability payments. You pay that tax on an amount of income up to about $69,000 a year in 1998, and that ceiling of how much you pay your Social Security taxes on rises each year according to inflation. If we were to raise payroll taxes by 2 percentage points, that is from 12.4% up to about 14.4%, really it's just a shade more than that, we would, at least in theory, get enough money so that over the 75-year planning horizon used by the Social Security Administration, the system would break even. So we would solve the system's problems for up till the year 2075, basically, by increasing the payroll tax by 2 percentage points. So, why not do this? This sort of has an advantage of simplicity. There's all this arguing, why don't we just add 2% and we fix the problem? Well, it's worth remembering that this 2% addition is not nothing. If you make $50,000 a year, an extra tax of 2% is an extra $1,000 in taxes per year. An extra $1,000 is not nothing. Moreover, while this would fix the system up to about 2070 or 2075, it leaves a gaping hole after that time. Now, you might say, well, heck, I don't care that much. I expect to be dead in the year 2070. But I assure you that if you're a 21-year-old just entering the system now, you're thinking, I'm only going to be 90 years old, and I might still be alive then. And all the people entering the system over time in the next few decades are certainly not going to be happy with the thought that the system is going to go bust about when they're ready to retire. So we need to think about the longer-term solutions as well. Moreover, there's no guarantee that this 2% solution will be enough. The 2% is based on a range of demographic projections about birth rates and death rates and retirement rates and all those kinds of things. All of these are somewhat uncertain. If you look at all these uncertainties, one estimate is that this 2% solution is only 25% likely to be enough. And there's a 75% chance it wouldn't actually be enough. Moreover, the 2% solution has to happen right away. You have to start taxing that extra money now and putting it aside. You can't just sit around until 2020 or 2025 and then say, oh, well, I think we'd like to raise taxes. At that point, you're going to need a whole lot more money. What's the second sort of solution? A second sort of solution might be slower growth of retirement benefits. Since 1975, Social Security has automatically gone up with inflation. The benefits have risen with inflation automatically. But before that time, through the 40s and 50s and 60s and early 70s, Congress just made adjustments to Social Security payments whenever it saw fit. And typically, it bumped them up in election years just before all the elderly went out and voted. In that sense, it's not breaking the original covenant of Social Security to go back to how things were done for the first 40 years of the system and not make the adjustments automatically with inflation, but make them as Congress sees fit. One set of arguments, which we'll be talking about in a later lecture, is that the way in which we calculate inflation in this country overstates the true rate of inflation by about 1% a year. Whether you believe that argument or don't believe that argument, there are proposals out there which say, why don't we just have Social Security grow at the measured inflation rate minus 1% each year? So it wouldn't be adjusted upward by the full amount of inflation, but by 1% less. If you do that over a few decades, you can save about one-third of what you need to save Social Security in the long term. Yet another option would be to tax Social Security benefits. Under the 1983 Commission, the Greenspan Commission, they began taxing some Social Security benefits as income. The rule here seems to be, at the moment, if you're elderly and you have income more than about $25,000, depending on whether you're married or single, the number varies, then you have to include half of your Social Security benefits as taxable income, but the other half is still tax-free. So you could go out and tax the other half of Social Security benefits, but actually it doesn't seem like there's a whole ton of money in doing this, because a lot of the elderly don't have a whole lot of income above $25,000. We can also think about cutting benefits in various ways. And when we talk about cutting benefits, usually this is done in various concealed ways because no one can quite say it openly. One way of cutting benefits, for example, is to have a later retirement age. From an economic point of view, getting the same benefits but at a later age is actually just, that's what a benefit cut means. It means you would get lower benefits at what used to be the retirement age and the same benefits at a later age. Of course, politically, it sounds better to say move back the retirement age, but functionally, it's just a benefit cut. Some of this is already happening as part of the Greenspan Commission in 1983. From 2000 to 2005, the normal retirement age will rise gradually from 65 to 66 years. Then it'll hang at 66 until 2016. Then from 2017 to 2022, it'll gradually rise from 66 to 67. Presumably, we could speed this up, or we could continue on past 67 to 68 or 69. The argument here is that, you know, people's lives are getting longer, and as life expectancy goes up, it makes some sense to raise the retirement age. In fact, we could even build in automatic adjustments for changes in life expectancy. The idea would just be that as life expectancy goes up, we automatically reduce people's benefits according to some formula which just takes into account the fact that people's lives are longer.
The argument is, you've earned a certain amount of benefits by paying into the system over your whole life, but if you're going to live longer than expected, then that amount that's saved up needs to be spread over more years. And in fact, Sweden has legislation in place that automatically reduces their old age benefits as life expectancy goes up. Not sure this is a political winner, but it could certainly have some effect over time. There's also a lot of tinkering with the benefits formula that goes on. For example, what has happened now is that your benefits are based on your 35 years where you earned the highest amount. We could, instead of that, say that your benefits would be based on, say, the average of your 38 highest years or your 40 highest earning years. And since you would be adding these extra 3 or 5 years where you had less income, that would bring down the overall average and would bring down the amount of benefits that you receive. A final approach to reducing benefits, I sort of think of as a reduction in benefits because people prefer it, would be to give better incentives for the elderly to work. There's a real interaction between government programs and working. When the U.S. began to allow early retirement in the early 1960s, early retirement at age 62, that's when the retirement age goes down very, very sharply. We could penalize early retirement. We could offer much lower benefits for retiring early. And we could also say that if you work after age 65, well, you're going to get higher benefits over time and reward people for working longer hours. Otherwise, it becomes sort of a funny thing. It's almost like the welfare situation where if you decide to work, you're not getting your Social Security payments and you're also paying taxes. And by the time you take those things into account, it's like having, say, a tax rate that might be 50% or something like that. So what we really want to think about is how we could encourage people to work longer. Now, people get pretty grumpy about this sort of suggestion. It's kind of like people saying, I deserve to retire at 62, and anything else is an imposition on my basic human rights. But that's not a fair way to look at this. After all, I don't think we need to be harsh on people. We don't need to prevent people from retiring. But there's no reason to say that we shouldn't reward people for staying in the workforce longer and longer and encouraging them to retire at a later age, particularly as life expectancies grow. Another broad approach to fixing Social Security is to invest some of the trust fund in stocks. Remember that in our early lecture on the stock markets, we pointed out that there's an equity premium. That is, you get paid more for stocks than you do for bonds. So if we were to just put some of the Social Security trust fund into stocks, we'd get higher interest. And higher interest would help make sure that we didn't run into these money problems as soon. In a way, this looks like a no-brainer, but it's actually more complicated than you might think. If everyone is trying to buy stocks, then the price of stocks is going to get higher and higher, and their future return as a result would be lower and lower. To put it a little bit differently, the returns on stocks and bonds in the future are determined by what companies do in the U.S. economy over time, what interest rates are, how the economy performs, things like that. If the Social Security owns a lot more stocks, then people are going to own fewer stocks. And they're going to have to buy something else. I mean, maybe it'll be bonds, which would be a natural thing for them to buy. And so overall, when you think of the total savings that's happening for the retirement generation, reshuffling who owns what, so the trust fund owns more stocks and people owns more bonds, doesn't change the overall amount of retirement income which is going to be available. It's just reshuffling who owns what things. So there's no guarantee that that really saves people's overall retirement picture, even though it would make the trust fund look better. Yet another proposal is to try and grow the economy out of its problems. A larger economy in the year 2020 or 2030 would make it easier to pay off the amounts owed to retirees. So if we could go with the whole proposal we've had before for higher productivity, savings, investment, education, R&D, building up budget surpluses, then we could add to national savings. And in the long term, this should mean that we are able to fix the Social Security system to at least some extent. Or at least we'll get over the hump. In the very long term, we actually still have a funny problem, which is if we push up everybody's wages, then everyone will be owed more Social Security benefits in the future, too. But that's the very long term. We could at least get over the hump in 2030. A final big set of proposals for fixing Social Security is to privatize the system. The typical proposal is to sort of partially privatize Social Security. That is, the government would continue to guarantee everyone a minimum payment, which would be the same for everyone, but people would also put aside maybe 2% of their salary in a retirement account invested in assets of their own choice. And the nation of Chile is the poster child for this kind of reform. They designed their entire system as totally privately run in this way. And as long as Chile's economy and stock market did pretty well, up until about 1998, the plan was very popular in Chile. Of course, when the market slumped, people weren't so happy. What are some of the difficulties that could come up with privatization? Well, it's worth remembering that privatization would involve the creation of tens of millions of accounts, rather than having one big account like the Social Security Trust Fund. And even small charges for running these accounts would be very controversial. Imagine you're young and starting off. You have a job that pays $30,000. Of that, you put 2% in your Social Security account. That's $600 you put in the first year. You invest it in a way that earns 8% interest, so the 8% on the $600 is $48 in interest. Now, if it costs maybe $20 a year as a service fee to run your account, you're not going to be too thrilled. That's almost half of your return going out to a service charge. So plans, as in Chile, often regulate the costs of what the accounts would cost in one way or another. So that's one level of regulation. A next level of regulation is to regulate the risks people can take. After all, if people are allowed to take really speculative chances with their private retirement fund, some are going to lose all their money, and the door is going to be wide open to all kinds of hucksters and self-promoters. So, typically when you have retirement funds, you also have to restrict how much money people can put into wild things, or maybe say they can only put it in mutual funds. In Chile, they go so far as to take from successful mutual funds and give to less successful funds, because they don't want to give people an incentive to run wild and take crazy risks. A third level of regulation is to regulate the withdrawals from these accounts. When you withdraw at retirement, do you get all your money at once, or do you have to take it over time? What about when Congress wants to pass a law that says you can dip into that money for medical expenses or college tuition or house down payments or for legal liability if you've done something terrible? Can you use this as collateral when you borrow? How does it get divided up in divorces? How do you leave it in wills? You can come up with answers to all of these questions, but boy, they're real questions, and they're going to require regulation on regulation upon regulation. Finally, when we think about privatization, there's going to be a need for some sort of transition tax. Take somebody like me. I'm in my late 30s. If I retire at age 70, it'll be just about when the fund is going broke. So let's say I take part of my money and I start putting it in a private account now. So as a result of me putting money in a private account now, less is going to be available for the current elderly or for those who are scheduled to retire over the next few decades. So if I get to put money in a private account, then the current system goes broke more quickly. And we need to think about extra funding for the current system. Thus, privatization plans for Social Security often say something like, everyone has to pay an extra 2%, that is the 2% solution, but you get to put your 2% in a personal account. You get to sweeten the tax increase, if you will, by actually holding it in a private account. A final concern about all of these issues is people may shift their assets around. After all, we can require people to put more in a Social Security account, but if they have less in their IRA or less in their 401k, or they borrow more on their credit card, or they borrow more on their home equity, then overall their savings won't have increased, and the accounts won't really have changed how ready people are to put aside money for retirement. So, with this sort of argument for privatization and these concerns, it's worth trying to cut through the hype a little bit and say, what are the real reasons for privatization? All of the early reforms I listed, stuff like the 2% solution, putting money into equities, changing the retirement age, all those kinds of things you can do without private accounts. So those aren't arguments for privatizing. Those are just reforms you can take whether you privatize or not. It seems to me that the underlying reasons for privatizing come down to more subtle things. One is that we know that we need to have people pay more into the system, and privatizing is kind of a trade-off, that if they pay more into the system, we let them hold it in a private account. So in that sense, it's a political argument. We could increase taxes and not have private accounts, but politically, we need to give people something if we're going to raise the taxes. Another thing is that we want people to get involved in thinking about their own retirement, thinking about how much money they have, not just focusing on Social Security as their entire retirement. And so, by having these accounts, we would get people more involved and interested in their future retirement. Well, this is an okay reason. It doesn't have a heck of a lot to do with Social Security. It just has to do with getting people organized into their savings in better ways. And a final concern is that we don't trust the government to hold these Social Security surpluses without spending them. In the late 1990s, for example, when we had Social Security surpluses that were leading to budget surpluses, a lot of congressmen wanted to immediately go out and spend those surpluses or give them back in the form of tax cuts. If people were holding that money in private accounts, then it wouldn't be part of the government budget and they wouldn't be able to spend that money. There are people out there who sort of say, in a resolute kind of way, Social Security has worked really well for 60 years, and if it ain't broke, don't fix it. It can hold on till 2030, so why bother? I think that whole kind of view is really foolishly optimistic. The sorts of problems we talk about here are not made up. They're real problems. And for people entering the Social Security system today, you're basically saying to those people, the system won't be there for you when you retire. For the next few generations, Social Security is a breakdown waiting to happen. We need to experiment with a broad range of these reforms and think seriously about privatization accounts.